And happy Sabbath, brethren. And thank you, Mr. Shemmett, for the very, as always, lovely special music. Whenever, as most of you know, whenever you see Paul Shemmett perform, I always think when he does the piano, it's kind of like just the accordion sideways. One uses, obviously, I know the difference between a piano and an accordion. But that's the way I look at it. He's still playing keys, but they're horizontal, not vertical. So thank you for that. I was queried before the services. They said, well-meaning, I'm sure. They asked, I sure hope you have a good message. I said, I don't. It's mediocre at best. They said, well, we have visitors. I said, you won't after I'm done. No, I'm kidding, of course. Those of you that are visitors, you're welcome today, this Sabbath, and every Sabbath, all the time, as Mr. Fish said. In the last month, as you heard in the first message, as you well know, over the last 2 months, almost to the day, it has been anything but stable in the world. Unstable, crazy is probably a better attribute. In the war, and it is a war in the Middle East, Israel is versus nearly everyone. And again, that was touched on in the first message. Thousands are dead. Tens of thousands are wounded. Prisoners, as you know, have been released. Negotiations are on, then they're off, then they're on again. And it's hard to keep up with the news. But we're witnessing events that will never, ever be forgotten. No matter how it turns out, we will never forget this. The world will never be the same. People, unfortunately, are using the World War III or a term of war, the war of 2023. But what's odd about this war, this engagement, is the strange, illogical, dumbfounding bedfellows that have aligned with one another, the sides that have been taken. I'm just going to touch on one, and I'll be delicate here. I read article after article that seeming alliances with LGBTQ plus with the Gazans, I checked. It's one direction. They don't support the LGBTQ plus. Gazans don't in Palestine. These are strange people that have made alliances. That's how crazy it is. I checked. And I had a choice of subject this Sabbath. All speakers do. Continue with the Book of Acts and the series or world events. So I chose both. So today we'll continue with Acts. The title is, if you want a title, Acts 17, The World Turned Upside Down. Let's do the preface before we get into the verses, which are fascinating. They're all fascinating chapters, but it seems that it just gets more and more interesting. To me it does, and I hope to you as you read through the Book of Acts. We're going to see Paul, Silas, and others covering massive amounts of geography. It's typically on foot. They didn't go by train, plane, or automobile. They did all this by foot. They're going to be meet with some different people. We get some really, I've said this before, I'll say it again, we're going to get some really strange people this time. But note the differences as we read through this. It's for your edification. There will be new faces, new opposition from different directions, different groups, and different issues. But we will see this consistency that we have throughout the book of Acts, that the formula never changes by Paul and the apostles. It never deviates. It is always the same message that they proclaim. The events, the situations will change chapter by chapter and sometimes every 5 or 10 verses, but Paul never changes the formula, the message. And so we'll begin in verse 1, chapter 17. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. I'm not sure what else there'd be a synagogue of, right? Evangelicals? No? So a synagogue of the Jews. Then Paul, as was his custom, went to them, and for 3 Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that the Christ, the Messiah, had to suffer and rise again from the dead. And he said, quote, this Jesus, this individual, this Jesus whom I preach to you is the Messiah. He is the one. Verse 4, and some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks, the God-fearers we would call them, and not a few of the leading women, and they joined Paul and Silas. So we see something that we've read before. What's fascinating about this, he visits the synagogue of the Jews on 3 successive Sabbaths. It says, as was his custom. The Greek there is a very simple word. You may find it familiar. It's ethos, where we get the word ethic. It was his manner. It was his style. It's what he does. He observed the seventh-day Sabbath. And he knew. How did Paul know? Let me ask you a question. How did Paul know there would be Jews in the synagogue on the Sabbath? I will guarantee you 99 times out of 100 today, in the 21st century, if you go into a synagogue today, you will find Jewish people. Take it to the bank. But he also observed the Sabbath. In fact, this word was his custom, is used of Jesus in the Sabbath. If you wish to turn, we don't need to, but Luke 4:16. Same word, same reasons. It says he reasoned from them. He reasoned with them openly from the Old Testament scriptures and what had occurred recently with this person and individual Jesus. This Jesus was the Messiah. He was the Christ. That is the formula. From death to resurrection, it never, ever changes. This is Paul's message. What are the results in this case? Many Greeks, some Jews, and many prominent women. Very interesting. We're going to see this again. Prominent women. It means women of the first order. We don't know whether that was inside the synagogue or out. It doesn't matter. It just shows that women were involved. But I have a question for you. Back to the question of a synagogue. How many of you have been to a Jewish synagogue? Well, obviously this side has, but this side hasn't much. Not going to ask why. I have, in my family, we've been probably four or five times to different synagogues. We lived in New Jersey for quite a number of years and had occasion, friends of friends. How many have been in an Orthodox synagogue? True Orthodox. Were there women there? You got a 50-50 chance. 50-50 chance at best. How many have been to a Reformed? How many are conservative, Reconstructionist? How many have no idea what kind of synagogue they were in? Just a lot of Jewish people on a seventh-day Sabbath. Yeah. Well, just like Protestant Christianity, there are multiple varieties of Jews. One of the most interesting Reformed synagogues that I've been to, and many of you may have, is UCG in Phoenix East. I can remember years ago when the feast, it had a satellite feast in Phoenix. We had never been there, and I was asked, would you mind flying? We were in Oceanside. Would you mind flying one day? You and Becky will pay for the trip and speak to give them something different and crazy in Phoenix. I said, sure. So they picked us up from the airport. I don't know if it was Monty Knudsen. I don't think he wasn't. It was quite a few years ago. I don't think he was the pastor then. Somebody picked us up, and we went a long drive from the airport to UCG Phoenix East. What did we pull up in front of? A synagogue. So I turned to the driver and I said, have there been some changes I'm not aware of? He said, no, this is where we meet. And it was a Reformed synagogue. It was an absolutely fascinating place. As you know, it looks not a whole lot different, most synagogues, than the chair set up where we were. But what they had behind the pulpit, the bima, the pulpit, was this great big wooden box. How many of you have been to UCG Phoenix East? Wow. So you have been to a Reformed synagogue. You notice the box, they put a drape over it. After services, being the nosy individual that I am, I went up to them and I said, why are you draping the box? Well, there's some Hebrew letters on the front of it, and we're not sure what they mean. I said, okay, are we ready to go? Are you going to take down the drape? They said, yeah, we're going to take down the drape. And I said, my Hebrew is next to zero, non-existent, but I know what that word is. It's the word Torah. That's where the scrolls are kept. That's called the Ark. And it's a beautiful building. It has a Yahrzeit wall. How many are familiar with the Yahrzeit, where they remember the dead first year of their passing? It was a fascinating place. The roof of this building, I don't know if you've noticed, is a scroll. It's kind of a book scroll. Just absolutely gorgeous. You could tell I was quite taken with it. But the word synagogue today and the word in the first century is not the same, not even close. Today, in most synagogues, almost all people are welcome. Our local Orange County synagogues, less than a mile away from our home, will accept anyone. And it's a conservative, near-Orthodox synagogue. But the origins and the structure of the first century synagogue is clouded in mystery. The academic literature that I could access gives one the feeling we just don't know that much. We know plenty in the 200s, 300s, and on. But in researching, generally, and through some old notes, I uncovered an article by a well-known scholar. Many of you may remember the name. In 1995, his monograph, quote, Synagogues in Pre-70 Palestine, a Reassessment, unquote, by Lester J. Grabe, at the University of Hull, who has since retired from, states this, and I'll read this slowly. It's kind of a long quote. I apologize. He writes, "For 2,000 years, the synagogue has been the center of religious life. Nor would anyone want to present any different picture from the time of the Mishnah, which is the Oral Torah, around 200 AD, from the time of the Mishnah to the present day. There seems no question that the synagogue plays the role assumed for it both inside and outside Palestine, at least by the Amoric times, 200 to 400 AD. It is when we move back to the time of the Second Temple that the standard assumptions about synagogues, as about so many things in Judaism, can no longer be taken for granted." He basically says, we just don't know. Do you know what one of the biggest sources of information on the Jewish synagogue of the first century is? Do you know what it is? This. The Jews left very little writings for the time period. So archaeologically, we know that they were used for Torah reading and prayer and debate, discussion, open discussion. And this development of the synagogue in the first century was perfect, absolutely tailor-made for the preaching of the gospel. In fact, what I think is fascinating, yes, there were synagogues in 200 BC, possibly in Egypt outside of Palestine, and not until the first century, lo and behold, almost as a miracle, arriving on time, Jesus shows up along with the development or the beginning of the development of the synagogue, a place for preaching the gospel. But I will warn you ahead of time, you may be ahead of me, do not walk into a modern synagogue today, stand up and preach the gospel. I will guarantee you it will not end nicely. They're on to us. They've read the New Testament. The article by Dr. Graeber, the article itself, caused a ruckus at the time in 95, as did follow-up articles. He didn't relent. They are well published in the literature. He again posits that the synagogue first appeared outside Jerusalem in some form and then flourished in Israel proper by the 1st to 3rd century. But as a religious community-oriented facility, it had both religious aspects, especially on Sabbath, but during the week it was very community-oriented. Everyone was invited. In a recent article in Bible Odyssey titled First Century Synagogues by Chad Spiegel, he says, "Though synagogues were found in some first century communities, their status as places of worship was limited until after the temple was destroyed in 70 CE, and that was referenced in the first message by Mr. Marinos. Without the temple, synagogues provided already established communal institutions that would ultimately develop into the new centers of Jewish worship," unquote. And that's what we see today. That's exactly what they are. They are very Jewish-oriented, but they are also extremely community-oriented, a place for prayer, Torah reading, and debate. Let's read verses 5 and on with that knowledge. Verse 5, "But the Jews who were not persuaded became envious, took some of the evil men," I love the King James here, the baser sort, bad guys, riffraff, "some of the evil men from the marketplace, and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason," poor Jason, "and sought to bring them out to the people. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some brethren," you get the image here? "And some brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, 'These who have turned the world upside down have come here too. Jason has harbored them, and they are all acting contrary." Notice what the difference is here. "They are acting contrary, not to the law of Moses, but to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, this Jesus. And they troubled the crowd and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. So when they had taken security, basically bail, from Jason and the rest, they let them go. Then the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. When they arrived," I didn't think they'd go over. "When they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews." Once again, it's a synagogue. What else would it be of? Synagogue of the Jews. "These were more fair-minded," more noble, as it is in some translations, "than those in Thessalonica. In that they received the word with all readiness, they searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, and also not a few of the Greeks, prominent women as well as men. But when the Jews from Thessalonica," remember they're in Berea, "when the Jews from Thessalonica learned that the word of God was preached by Paul at Berea, They came there also and stirred up the crowds. Then immediately the brethren sent Paul away to go to the sea. But both Silas and Timothy remained there. So those who conducted Paul brought him to Athens. And receiving a command from Silas and Timothy to come to him with all speed, they departed. Again, they go from city to city, synagogue to synagogue. Poor Jason. We don't know much about Jason. He's maybe referenced in the book of Thessalonians. We're not sure he's the same guy. But they basically arrest him, hold him hostage, and he has to be bailed out. But the unreceptive Jews from a prior city from Thessalonica, they go to Berea. They are trolling them. They're not going to let this stand. There's a rabble, the rabble-rousers from the marketplace. What's fascinating, and I checked with the local Greek scholar that we have here in the congregation, this is the marketplace, the Stoa. This is where they did the discussions. They're in Athens in particular, in different places in different city-states in Greece. They grab rabble-rousers from the marketplace and the city officials, but they appeal not to the law of Moses this time. In prior chapters, you'll remember, the Jews attacked them for they had, allegedly Paul had taken down or was in contrary to, opposition to, the law of Moses. Here, nope, Rome and Caesar are brought in. They're in Greece. And many of these cities are what are known as free cities. They're not but loosely connected to Rome. This is what they're invoking. Caesar is the king. They turned the world, verse 6, upside down. King Jesus is not our king, they said. Caesar is. Does that sound familiar to you? It should. In John 19:15, if you want to turn there, in John 19:15, this is during Jesus' trial. This is Pilate presenting Christ to the crowd. But they cried, he says, "Behold your king," verse 14, "Behold your king," verse 15. But they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. And then they took Jesus and led him away. Back to Acts. John 19:15 says, this is a constant refrain. "We have no king, but we have Caesar." In verse 10, it says that Paul goes to Berea and another synagogue. These are more fair-minded. They are more honest individuals, and many accept the gospel. Once again, Greeks, God-fearers, prominent men, and women. But we said the Thessalonican Jews that were unreceptive followed them. They're tracking them. They make the claim to the city officials that they have turned this world upside down. In verse 15, Paul and company go to Athens. I was intrigued by the phrase, "the world turned upside down." When I first remember hearing, I was a little boy, the word upside down. How many of you know of an upside down cake? Wow. How many of you know, here's the kicker, how many of you have heard of a pineapple upside down cake? Wow. You've been to our house. So Mom, what are you making? I'm making a pineapple upside down cake. What? What's an upside down cake? And as you know, they put the pineapples first, build it up from there, and cook it. Then you flip it upside down. So the bottom side is now the top side. That is the first time I heard that phrase. What's interesting, turning the world upside down is exactly what Paul and the apostles had done to the people of Thessalonica. He will do it to Athens. He did it to Berea. He did it everywhere he went. So let me ask you a question. Oh, sorry, Frank. I am old. The eyes just don't work like they used to. Within the context of Thessalonica, Paul and Silas were in many synagogues and Jewish settings. Jews, God-fearers, Greeks, everybody. Yet in a manner of hours, fierce opposition faced them. Jews who weren't convinced Christ was the Messiah tried to oppose them over and over again. Jews telling Greek town rulers they were plotting insurrection. Wrong king. This king is not Jesus. It's Rome and Caesar. Being attacked religiously, politically, from every possible side, culturally, from getting it from all sides. They had indeed turned the immediate world upside down. Their world was rocked. Indeed, they were simply speaking the truth. You heard it in the first message. We say it often from this pulpit and can't say it enough, that Jesus is the Messiah, he is the Lord and the King, and that rocks worlds. If you were to ask Paul and the apostles, what was your intent? They'd probably answer, to rock their world, to turn it completely and utterly upside down. That's with their intent. What's interesting about this chapter, it should remind us as well that your world was once turned upside down. You once were made of the very same thing, the same ideas that this Jesus is the one, the only one. You too were faced with the proposition to prove the truth of what you knew. You searched the scriptures, both Old and New Testaments, that this one was God's very Son sent by God, and you had to make a decision. Your worldview changed dramatically. It had to. It turned your world upside down, or should have. It affected the day you worship on. It affected the food you ate, the things you believed, the laws you keep and obey, the promises that you understand that need to be kept. All that changed. It could have taken a day, a week, a series of months. You learned regarding the ultimate fate of fellow believers, the future, like our good friend John Lyons. We will see him again. You learned that John 3:16 says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him, believes in him, will have everlasting life. You read John 14:15 with a new understanding. It says, if you love me, what's the rest of the verse? Keep my commandments. See, you remember, you were compelled to respond, not for my question, but when you read it. It had rocked Paul's, Silas's, and Timothy's world, all of them. It's really taken a page out of last message with Mr. Helge last Sabbath, and it affects us and what we do, what we see, and the way we interpret the world around us. It has to. Acts 17 should prepare us for what we see around us, the world events, the cultural aspects, the business, the ideological, all of it. It affects us, and we change the way we look at it through our worldview. This month, the last month or so, is a test. Not so much a test with what's going on in the Middle East. That is a test. But another test is this season. What's behind drape number 3, Harry? I couldn't resist. Hey, this year we don't have one. We have 2. Yeah, trust me. By the way, I like the Hanukkah wreaths. Why didn't we drape those? They're a reminder, and we need occasional reminders. This time of year is a hard time of year for a lot of people. It's full of landmines. I warn you, strange holidays come ahead. Tread very, very carefully. We just finished witnessing your day or two of the veneration of the dead, of witches and ghosts. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? And indeed it was for millions and millions of people. It's a strange season of the year, isn't it? It's going to get even stranger. Now we'll see tree lightings, toy drives. Again, look around. We will hear well-meaning Merry Christmas. Did you have a nice Christmas? Did you get what you wanted for Christmas? Sounds simple questions. They are not simple questions. Your response must be measured, sincere, and respectful. It has to be. We surely believe that Jesus Christ was born. We can read Luke and Matthew. He was born in a manger. Would you agree? I don't see heads nodding. Are you reading? He was born in a manger, right? His parents were with him. Were there sheep there? Yeah. Were there wise men? Yeah. December 25th? No. So we understand that Christ was born. We surely believe that. But let me give you some suggestions, if I may. Because I did some polling. Many of you I contacted. I tried to contact as many as I could, and I had to stop at one point. When you are greeted with the phrase, Merry Christmas, how do you respond? One response is, I don't celebrate pagan holidays, pagan. Here are some booklets. Have a nice day. Or, let me explain the historical problem with this season that you celebrate. Got 2 or 3 hours? Or, one of my favorites, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Well, I don't celebrate Hanukkah. Well, I don't celebrate Christmas. But the number one answer, what do you think it might be? That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Anything more than that, you're treading on unsafe waters. Now, if they ask you, what kind of, did you get the presents you want? We haven't got enough time to figure out how to. That I leave to you carefully, respectfully, prayerfully. Prayerfully again. Because these people are sincere. They're sincerely wrong, but we need to tread very, very carefully. Let's continue. Let's continue with Acts 17, 16, verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. By the way, how many of you have been to Athens? Quite a few of you. You know what they call those idols now? By the way, for those of you not that have never gone to Athens, the idols are still there. They call them now tourist attractions. But some of those same idols and edifices that are in Athens existed in Paul's day. It is unbelievable. It's a fascinating city. We'll talk about it more next time. So the city was given over to idols. Verse 17. Therefore, he reasoned in the... Guess where he went? You get one guess. That's right, the synagogue of the Presbyterians. He went to the synagogue of the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers. The word Gentile there is added. You mean the non-Jewish worshipers. They could be Greek, they could be whatever they are. And in the marketplace, daily with those who happen to be there. Now, if you've been to Athens, you've been to the Acropolis, right? Do you know where the marketplace is? Right below. It's less than 2 or 3 football fields. I Googled it. You can walk it in just a few minutes. So he's in the marketplace. He's in the marketplace. What is he doing? He's debating them. He's discussing with the people that are around him the gospel message. Though, by the way, I love this phrase. In the marketplace daily, just with whoever happened to be there. It didn't matter who it was. He took on all comers because that's what they did in this area. Then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, those are two divisions of Greek philosophy, they encountered him. And some said, what does this babbler want to say? The word babbler there, does anybody have the word sparrow? It means the literal translation of the word babbler there is seed picker. I kid you not. Look it up. They basically called him a type of bird that goes on the ground and picks apart certain seeds, just picking. That's what they called Paul. Paul the seed picker. Others said he seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods. Obviously, he was talking about this King Jesus because he preached to them about Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus. This is the Greek term for Mars Hill. They said, quote, may we know what this new doctrine, this new teaching, can we know what this is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. They'd never heard this before. Can you imagine what Paul's reaction was? Right? New opportunities. May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak, for you're bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean. For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear something new. Some new thing. Paul, I'm sure, saw this as a tremendous opportunity for him. We're going to look at this from the standpoint of the cultural milieu of Athens in the Greek time of the first century. It is very cosmopolitan, a very busy place, but we're going to leave Paul in Athens for the next time. And we'll read of a speech he made. How many of you have been to Areopagus one more time? You know. Don't say it to anybody else. No telling about how they're closely aligned and what the people saw when Paul spoke. It's very obvious what they saw. So don't tell everybody because this is such a really condensed place in Greece, in Athens. So we leave Paul in Athens for next time. We'll talk about the speech that he made. And it is more living for Paul and the apostles of living in Babylon, in Rome, in Greece. What can we conclude from all of this? Acts 17 tells us a story historically of what Paul and the apostles did in preaching the gospel. It is important. These men were fearless. All the people that preached the gospel were. But it also reminds us of our situation, personally, as it was for Paul and the people with him. The world has been turned upside down. Your world and the world today. Again, geopolitically, culturally, morally, locally, and also personally. Change has been rapid and stunning. If you'd have told me 6 months ago this would be happening in the Middle East, I'd have said you're crazy. But look what's happened so short a time. But we too, personally, have had our world turned upside down. The knowledge and the awareness that we have, that you and I have been given, cannot have a price put on it. But it also should shape us and mold us. It should change us that we are never the same again. The problem that we will find is that as we go through life, we are going to make mistakes, many mistakes. If I ask for a show of hands of someone that has not made at least 20 mistakes in their Christian walk, we wouldn't believe you. We all make mistakes. So again, let me give you some suggestions, this time some serious ones. As we go through life, I think there's some aspects from Acts 17 that we learn. Number one, we should go through this life confidently, not arrogantly, but confidently, and pray for opportunities as we encounter people, as the situation presents itself, just exactly as Paul and the apostles did. We do it humbly. We treat others as we would like to be treated. It's a hard thing to do. It's easy to say. Treating other people the way you want to be treated. Because you first have to think, how would I like to be treated? You first have to answer that question. But we do so humbly. Because this is what God uses people to see. It's what they see about us. What they hear and they see is us. And what we think, what we say, and how we approach other people. As we go through life confidently and humbly, we should use God's Spirit. Because again, as a reminder, all of us in this room have one thing in common. We're all flesh. We're all still flesh. We still stumble and fall, both physically and spiritually. So use God's Spirit. Next, go as a learner, a constant and ever, always learning and understanding student of God's Word. That can never, ever stop. It must be lifelong, because this book is a big book. And it has so much to tell us. So go also as a learner. And lastly, and very importantly, as we suffer through this life, go joyfully, happily. As we go through this world, as we leave this building, and the world it is turned upside down, our world view should be what? Right side up. Right side up. We are joyful because we know that Christ will one day return and indeed restore the kingdom of kingdoms, his and God's kingdom. We heard it, I think, I counted it in one of the hymns. I counted it, I think, in the opening prayer, and I know that I heard it in the first message. As we suffer in this life, and all of us will suffer to one degree or another, we see and experience suffering. These are the ways that we endure the suffering and the trials that we have. Humbly, confidently, as a learner, and we do it joyfully. Happy Sabbath.